Chapter 24. Decency of a kid glove, but a piece of pork in a naked hand? Oh nerves and oh the cologne, hide it, hide it. In spite of this lamentable coarseness, my noble sergeant, give me thy hand as nature made it. A great, and famous, and noble handiwork I have seen here. Not the greatest picture in the world, not a work of the highest genius, but a performance so great, various, and admirable, so shrewd of humor, so wise of observation, so honest and complete of expression, that to have seen it has been a delight, and to remember it will be a pleasure for days to come. Well done, Bartholomew van der Helst. Brave, meritorious, victorious, happy Bartholomew, to whom it has been given to produce a masterpiece. May I take off my hat, and pay a respectful compliment to Jan Steen Esquire? ? He is a glorious composer. His humor is as frank as Fielding's. Look at his own figure sitting in the windowsill yonder, and roaring with laughter. What a twinkle in the eyes. What a mouth it is for a song, or a joke, or a noggin. I think the composition in some of Jan's pictures amounts to the sublime, and look at them with the same delight and admiration which I have felt before works of the very highest style. This gallery is admirable, and the city in which the gallery is perhaps even more wonderful and curious to behold than the gallery. The first landing at Calais, or, I suppose, on any foreign shore, the first sight of an eastern city, the first view of Venice and this of Amsterdam, are among the delightful shocks which I have had as a traveler. Amsterdam is as good as Venice, with a superadded humor and grotesqueness, which gives the sightseer the most singular zest and pleasure. A run through Pekin I could hardly fancy to be more odd, strange, and yet familiar. This rush, and crowd, and prodigious vitality, this immense swarm of life, these busy waters, crowding barges, swinging drawbridges, piled ancient gables, spacious markets teeming with people, that ever wonderful Jews' quarter, that dear old world of painting and the past, yet alive, and throbbing, and palpable actual, and yet passing before you swiftly and strangely as a dream. Of the many journeys of this roundabout life, that drive through Amsterdam is to be specially and gratefully remembered. You have never seen the Palace of Amsterdam, my dear sir? Why, there's a marble hall in that palace that will frighten you as much as any hall in Vathek, or a nightmare. At one end of that old, cold, glassy, glittering, ghostly, marble hall there stands a throne, on which a white marble king ought to sit with his white legs gleaming down into the white marble below, and his white eyes looking at a great white marble atlas, who bears on his icy shoulders a blue globe as big as the full moon. If he were not a genie, and enchanted, and with a strength altogether hyper-Atlantean, he would drop the moon with a shriek onto the white marble floor, and it would splitter into perdition. And the palace would rock, and heave, and tumble, and the waters would rise, 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 and the gables sink, 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 and the barges would rise up to the chimneys, and the water sauchy fishes would flap over the boomages, where the pigeons and storks used to perch, and the Amster, and the Rotter, and the Saar, and the Yop, and all the dams of Holland would burst, and the Zuider Zee roll over the dikes. And you would wake out of your dream, and find yourself sitting in your armchair. Was it a dream? It seems like one. Have we been to Holland? Have we heard the chimes at midnight at Antwerp? Were we really away for a week, or have I been sitting up in the room dozing, before this stale old desk? Here's the desk, yes. But, if it has been a dream, how could I have learned to hum that tune out of Denora? Ah, is it that tune, or myself that I am humming? If it was a dream, how comes this yellow notice de tableau du Musée d'Amsterdam avec facsimile de monograms before me, and the signature of the gallant Bartholomew van der Helst, Fessedau, 1648? Yes, indeed, it was a delightful little holiday. It lasted a whole week. With the exception of that little pint of Amari aliquid at Rotterdam, we were all very happy. We might have gone on being happy for whoever knows how many days more. A week more, 10 days more. Who knows how long that dear teetotum happiness can be made to spin without toppling over. But one of the party had desired letters to be sent postery stand, Amsterdam. The post office is hard by that awful palace where the Atlas is, and which we really saw. There was only one letter, you see. Only one chance of finding us. There it was. He post has only this moment come in, says the smirking commissioner. And he hands over the paper, thinking he has done something clever. Before the letter had been opened, I could read come back, as clearly as if it had been painted on the wall. It was all over. The spell was broken. The sprightly little holiday fairy, that had frisked and gambolled so kindly beside us for 8 days of sunshine or rain, which was as cheerful as sunshine, gave a parting piteous look, and whisked away and vanished. And yonder scuds the postman, and here is the old desk. Nil nisi bonum. Almost the last words which Sir Walter spoke to Lockhart, his biographer, were, "Be a good man, my dear." And with the last flicker of breath on his dying lips, he sighed a farewell to his family, and passed away blessing them. Two men, famous, admired, beloved, have just left us, the Goldsmith and the Gibbon of our time. *** Ere a few weeks are over, many a critic's pen will be at work, reviewing their lives, and passing judgment on their works. This is no review, or history, or criticism. Only a word in testimony of respect and regard from a man of letters, who owes to his own professional labor the honor of becoming acquainted with these two eminent literary men. One was the first ambassador whom the New World of Letters sent to the old. He was born almost with the Republic. The Pater Patriae had laid his hand on the child's head. He bore Washington's name. He came amongst us bringing the kindest sympathy, the most artless, smiling goodwill. His new country, which some people here might be disposed to regard rather superciliously, could send us, as he showed in his own person, a gentleman, who, though himself born in no very high sphere, was most finished, polished, easy, witty, quiet, and, socially, the equal of the most refined Europeans. If Irving's welcome in Anglia, and was a kind one, was it not also gratefully remembered? If he ate our salt, did he not pay us with a thankful heart? Who can calculate the amount of friendliness and good feeling for our country which this writer's generous and untiring regard for us disseminated in his own? His books are read by millions of his countrymen, whom he has taught to love England, and why to love her. It would have been easy to speak otherwise than he did. To inflame national rancors, which, at the time when he first became known as a public writer, war had just renewed. To cry down the old civilization at the expense of the new. To point out our faults, arrogance, shortcomings, and give the Republic, to infer how much she was the parent state's superior. There are writers enough in the United States, honest and otherwise, who preach that kind of doctrine. But the good Irving, the peaceful, the friendly, had no place for bitterness in his heart, and no scheme but kindness. Received in England with extraordinary tenderness and friendship, Scott, Southey, Byron, 100 others have borne witness to their liking for him, he was a messenger of goodwill and peace between his country and ours. Friends. He seems to say, these English are not so wicked, rapacious, callous, proud, as you have been taught to believe them. I went amongst them a humble man, won my way by my pen, and, when known, found every hand held out to me with kindliness and welcome. Scott is a great man, you acknowledge. Did not Scott's King of England give a gold medal to him, and another to me, your countryman, and a stranger? *Washington Irving died, November 28, 1859. Lord Macaulay died, December 28, 1859. *See his life in the most remarkable dictionary of authors, published lately at Philadelphia, by Mr. Ellibone. tradition in the United States still fondly retains the history of the feasts and rejoicings which awaited Irving on his return to his native country from Europe. He had a national welcome. He stammered in his speeches, hid himself in confusion, and the people loved him all the better. He had worthily represented America in Europe. In that young community, a man who brings home with him abundant European testimonials is still treated with respect. I have found American writers, of wide world reputation, strangely solicitous about the opinions of quite obscure British critics, and later depressed by their judgments, and Irving went home medaled by the king, diplomatized by the university, crowned and honored and admired. He had not in any way intrigued for his honors. He had fairly won them, and, in Irving's instance, as in others, the old country was glad and eager to pay them. In America, the love and regard for Irving was a national sentiment. Party wars are perpetually raging there, and are carried on by the press with a rancor and fierceness against individuals which exceed British, almost Irish, virulence. It seemed to me, during a year's travel in the country, as if no one ever aimed a blow at Irving. All men held their hand from that harmless, friendly peacemaker. I had the good fortune to see him at New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Washington, asterisk and remarked how in every place he was honored and welcome. Every large city has its Irving House. The country takes pride in the fame of its men of letters. The gate of his own charming little domain on the beautiful Hudson River was forever swinging before visitors who came to him. He shut out no one. I had seen many pictures of his house, and read descriptions of it, in both of which it was treated with a not unusual American exaggeration. It was but a pretty little cabin of a place. The gentleman of the press who took notes of the place, whilst his kind old host was sleeping, might have visited the whole house in a couple of minutes. At Washington, Mr. Irving came to a lecture given by the writer, which Mr. Fillmore and General Pierce, the president and president-elect, were also kind enough to attend together. "Woe kings of Brentford smelling at one rose," says Irving, looking up with his good-humored smile. Mr. Irving described to me, with that humor and good humor which he always kept, how, amongst other visitors, a member of the British press who had carried his distinguished pen to America, where he employed it in vilifying his own country, came to Sunnyside, introduced himself to Irving, partook of his wine and luncheon, and in 2 days described Mr. Irving, his house, his nieces, his meal, and his manner of dozing afterwards, in a New York paper. On another occasion, Irving said, laughing, "Two persons came to me, and one held me in conversation, whilst the other miscreant took my portrait. And how came it that this house was so small, when Mr. Irving's books were sold by hundreds of thousands, nay, millions, when his profits were known to be large, and the habits of life of the good old bachelor were notoriously modest and simple? He had loved once in his life. The lady he loved died, and he, whom all the world loved, never sought to replace her. I can't say how much the thought of that fidelity has touched me. Does not the very cheerfulness of his afterlife add to the pathos of that untold story? To grieve always was not in his nature, or, when he had his sorrow, to bring all the world in to condole with him and bemoan it. Deep and quiet he lays the love of his heart, and buries it, and grass and flowers grow over the scarred ground in due time. Irving had such a small house and such narrow rooms, because there was a great number of people to occupy them. He could only afford to keep one old horse, which, lazy and aged as it was, managed once or twice to run away with that careless old horseman. He could only afford to give plain sherry to that amiable British paragraph monger from New York, who saw the patriarch asleep over his modest blameless cup, and fetched the public into his private chamber to look at him. Irving could only live very modestly, because the wifeless, childless man had a number of children to whom he was as a father. He had as many as 9 nieces. I am told I saw 2 of these ladies at his house with all, of whom the dear old man had shared the produce of his labor and genius. Be a good man, my dear. One can't but think of these last words of the veteran chief of letters, who had tasted and tested the value of worldly success, admiration, prosperity. Was Irving not good, and, of his works, was not his life the best part? And his family, gentle, generous, good-humored, affectionate, self-denying. In society, a delightful example of complete gentlemanhood. Quite unspoiled by prosperity. Never obsequious to the great, or, worse still, to the base and mean, as some public men are forced to be in his and other countries, eager to acknowledge every contemporary's merit. Always kind and affable to the young members of his calling. In his professional bargains and mercantile dealings, delicately honest and grateful. One of the most charming masters of our lighter language. The constant friend to us and our nation. To men of letters doubly dear, not for his wit and genius merely, but as an exemplar of goodness, probity, and pure life. I don't know what sort of testimonial will be raised to him in his own country, where generous and enthusiastic acknowledgement of American merit is never wanting. But Irving was in our service as well as theirs, and as they have placed a stone at Greenwich yonder in memory of that gallant young Bellet, who shared the perils and fate of some of our Arctic seamen, I would like to hear of some memorial raised by English writers and friends of letters in affectionate remembrance of the dear and good Washington Irving. As for the other writer, whose departure many friends, some few most dearly loved relatives, and multitudes of admiring readers deplore, our republic has already decreed his statue, and he must have known that he had earned this posthumous honor. He is not a poet and man of letters merely, but citizen, statesman, a great British worthy. Almost from the first moment when he appears, amongst boys, amongst college students, amongst men, he is marked, and takes rank as a great Englishman. All sorts of successes are easy to him. As a lad he goes down into the arena with others, and wins all the prizes to which he has a mind. A place in the Senate is straightway offered to the young man. He takes his seat there. He speaks, when so minded, without party anger or intrigue, but not without party faith and a sort of heroic enthusiasm for his cause. Still he is poet and philosopher even more than orator. That he may have leisure and means to pursue his darling studies, he absents himself for a while, and accepts a richly remunerative post in the East. As learned a man may live in a cottage or a college common room, but it always seemed to me that ample means and recognized rank were Macaulay's as of right. Years ago there was a wretched outcry raised, because Mr. Macaulay dated a letter from Windsor Castle, where he was staying. Immortal gods! Was this man not a fit guest for any palace in the world, or a fit companion for any man or woman in it? I dare say, after Austerlitz, the old KK court officials and footmen sneered at Napoleon for dating from Schönbrunn. But that miserable Windsor Castle outcry is an echo out of fast retreating old world remembrances. The place of such a natural chief was amongst the first of the land, and that country is best, according to our British notion at least, where the man of eminence has the best chance of investing his genius and intellect. If a company of giants were got together, very likely one or two of the mere 6 feet 6 people might be angry at the incontestable superiority of the very tallest of the party, and so I have heard some London wits, rather peevish at Macaulay's superiority, complain that he occupied too much of the talk, and so forth. Now that wonderful tongue is to speak no more, will not many a man grieve that he no longer has the chance to listen? To remember the talk is to wonder. To think not only of the treasures he had in his memory, but of the trifles he had stored there, and could produce with equal readiness. Almost on the last day I had the fortune to see him, a conversation happened suddenly to spring up about senior wranglers, and what they had done in after life. To the almost terror of the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.